The fire spread quicker than the little bastard was expecting.
Hello and welcome to this short fiction masterclass brought to you by Thresholds, the International Short Story Forum in collaboration with the Charleston Trust. My name is Jack Attanio and today I'm going to be talking to the novelist and short story writer John McGregor. John's first novel, If Nobody Speaks of Remarkable Things, won the Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year Award, the Betty Trask Prize, and the Somerset Maugham Award. Since then, he has published three more novels to critical acclaim. Even the Dogs won the International Dublin Literary Award in 2012, and John has thrice been longlisted for the Booker Prize. In this masterclass, John is going to talk to us about his short fiction collection. This isn't the sort of thing that happens to someone like you. We will explore the loss of innocence, the dangers of complacency, playing with form, and visions of the apocalypse. John, welcome, and thank you for talking to us about your collection. This isn't the sort of thing that happens to someone like you.
You're very welcome.
That's a very interesting title, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Again, it's another title I thought I wasn't going to get away with the publishers, but they were happy to let it go. It was a title that came quite late in the process. It was actually after I'd given the collection to a few people to read with a different title, and somebody found that line in one of the stories, and they said, "This is your title. This is what all the stories are about."
Yes.
And they kind of crystallised it, which was great.
And I think it is, because it's a bit like the denial that some of your characters go through when things are happening to them.
Yeah, denial and a kind of complacency
as
well, I think.
And I think that's well indicated in the story that you've agreed to read for us.
Sure, yeah. So this is Wires. It was a sugar beet, presumably, since that was a sugar beet lorry in front of her, and this thing turning in the air at something like 60 miles an hour had just fallen off it. It looked like a giant turnip and was covered in mud, and basically looked more or less like whatever she would have imagined a sugar beet to look like if she'd given it any thought before now, which she didn't think she had. It was totally filthy. They didn't make sugar out of that, did they? What did they do? Grind it? Cook it? Regardless, whatever, it was coming straight for her, meaning this was, what, one of those time slows down moments or something. Her life was presumably going to start flashing in front of her eyes right about now. She wondered why she hadn't screamed or anything. Oh, seemed to be about as much as she'd managed. But in the time it had taken to say, oh, she'd apparently had the time to make a list of all the things she was having the time to think about, like, i.e., item one, how she'd said, oh, without any panic or fear, and did that mean she was repressed, or just calm, or collected, or what? Item two, what would Marcus say when he found out? Would he try and find someone to blame, such as herself, for driving too close, or even for driving on her own at all, or such as the lorry driver for overloading the lorry? Or such as her, again, for not having joined the union like he told her to, like anyone was in a union these days, especially anyone with a part-time job who was still at uni and not actually all that bothered about pension rights or legal representation. Item three, she couldn't possibly be thinking all this in the time it was taking for the sugar beet to turn in the air and crash through the windscreen, if that's what it was going to do. And what then? Meaning, this must be like a neural pathway illusion or something. Item four, actually, Marcus did go on sometimes. He did reckon himself, and how come she thought things like that about him so often? Maybe she was being unfair because they were good together. People had told her they were good together, but basically she was confused and she didn't know where she stood. Item five, a witty and deadpan way of mentioning this on her status update would be something like, Emily Wilkinson is sweet enough already, thanks, without a sugar beet in the face. Although actually she wouldn't be able to put that if that's what was actually going to happen, thinking about it logically. Item six, although, does she really even know what a neural pathway was? Or was it just something she'd heard someone else talk about and decided to start saying? Item seven was just, basically, WTF.
Thank you, John. And that's a fantastic start to story. We have disaster impending, looming, the sugar beet. And when it comes through the windscreen and lands next to Emily, we're lulled into that false sense of security or complacency where we think that disaster has been averted. Possibly it's a story about Emily's relationship with Marcus. There might be some kind of epiphany that's happened because of the sugar beet. And then things start to change in the story. And gradually we become aware of something else. And it's only really the ending that delivers that. One of your reviewers said reading the story was like being mildly electrocuted. And I wondered if you could tell us about this story.
Yeah, I mean, this was a story, and it happens quite often when I'm writing short stories, And it's one of the joys of writing short stories is that you can stop when you realise you've got to the end, rather than having to reach a kind of predetermined 50,000 words or 100,000 words or whatever. You work on the story, and you know, with this one I had lots mapped out, and there was lots going to happen. She was going to get home, she was going to talk to her mother, there were all sorts of things were going to kind of elaborate. And I got to a point where the story finishes, and I just suddenly knew that that had to be the end of the story. Because it's the point where we leave Emily in a moment of real peril and in a moment of realising that she is in a situation of peril, and she realises much later than possibly the reader has realised, and she realises later than she'll realise the next time something like this happens. And so this is it's all about...
If there is a next time, because we don't know
if there is
what
a next
is
time.
Going to happen to
yeah,
her.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, the reader is left very uncertain. Like, is this going to be a lucky escape which serves as a cautionary tale, or is this something terrible? But it's about, I mean, the title of the story comes from the Philip Larkin poem, Wires, about cattle on American ranches and how once they brush up against the electric fence the first time, they never go anywhere near the boundary of the field again. Yeah, the youngest cattle become old steers from that day. And it's about that moment that I think we all go through at some point in our youth, where we suddenly realise we're not as safe as we thought we were. You know, and something happens. And for most of us, that something is just a cautionary tale. We're in a situation, we're out of our depth, we realise something terrible might have happened, and we're always more careful from then on. And it obviously is something that happens to young women more than it happens to young men. It happens probably sooner to young women than it happens to young men. And so that's why, you know, the protagonist in this story is a young woman. But it's the story that I've had probably the most pushback from readers about. You know, just often being asked, well, what does happen next? Why didn't you go further? And it was really important to me to stop the story at that point, because it's not about what happens next. It's about her finding herself in that situation, and her life changes. Her life, whatever happens next, her life has already changed. She can never again be confident around strangers, completely trusting around strangers.
So it's a loss of innocence.
Yeah.
It's some kind of initiation, right?
Yeah, and the fact is these men, you know, she's broken down, the windscreen smashed. The men stop and help her. They say they've called the police. Maybe they have. Maybe they are completely looking after her. Maybe nothing terrible is going on at all. But it's her realisation that she's in a situation where she doesn't know. That's her loss of innocence.
Yeah.
So that's where the story has to stop.
And I think it's a theme that seems to echo through some other stories as well. To me, there was a similarity between the ending of We Were Just Driving Around, where it's a group of young people in a car, joking with each other, having fun, and then the last line tells you something is going to happen. Again, you stop before the point of impact.
Yeah, although, I mean, I guess with that story, there's less ambiguity. The point of impact is coming. Yeah, I mean, I think in my writing I've often shied away from obvious drama. For me, it's not interesting to describe a car crash. It's interesting to describe what leads up to the car crash, to describe the kind of what was happening in the car, what the conversations that were going on, the reason for the momentary distraction, and the kind of energy that you have at that age when you're living out in the sticks, there's nothing to do, your mate gets a driving license for the first time, driving around, it's the most exciting thing you can do, which is why so many 17-year-olds crash, because it's just exciting and distracting. And so, yeah, so the story for me isn't what happens when the car starts tumbling over. I sort of don't care. I'm interested in that kind of split second beforehand.
And are you deliberately asking the reader to fill in that, the rest of the narrative?
Yeah.
Is that a deliberate opening out to the reader? Or do you feel that it doesn't really matter what happens after that?
I mean, it doesn't matter to me. What's important to me is to give the reader the opportunity to take part. For me, the biggest strength of writing on the page is the invitation it offers to the reader to do their own work and to fill in as many gaps as possible. And I think if anything, my journey as a writer has been and continues to be about pushing that and finding out how many more gaps I can leave.
Yes.
That's the exciting thing. You're trusting the reader.
Yes, absolutely. And I think gaps are interesting in your stories as well. They occur in other ways. There are gaps in what's said in relationships, for example. I'm thinking of that colour and In the Winter the Sky, those sorts of stories where things aren't being said between people in an intimate relationship, and those kind of gaps form almost the heart of a story.
Yeah, very much so. There's conversations where it's quite an English tradition, isn't it? The conversation where what's being said is not what's being spoken. It's all under the surface. It's in the inarticulacy. Yeah, that's always been interesting to me.
It seems that also there's a gap between what the reader knows and what's going on in the character's consciousness. The reader is privy to more information than the character.
Yeah. And sometimes giving the reader clues about the ways that the characters are misleading themselves.
Yes.
About their lives or their circumstances. You know, we see this in the people around us, don't we? We can see the way people mislead themselves and kind of trick themselves about their own motivations or their own journeys through life.
Well, I'm thinking in particular of a story, We Wave and Call, where the reader realises, because you've done a foreshadowing in the first paragraph, a sense of what's going to happen in the story, and then we're right inside the character's consciousness. It's a young boy, he's away from home for the first time with his friends, and he's swimming in the Mediterranean Sea, and he comes from a much wilder, much colder coast. And so he's lulled into, again, a complacency about the dangers he might be facing in the sea. So everything happens in a kind of slow motion. And your reader is aware that the character is in a different place from where they know he is.
Yeah, and I think, probably that story in particular, the reader assumes that things are going much more wrong than the character realises. And because, again, you know, the character is that age, that kind of pre-loss of innocence age. And again, if this character is to get back to dry land, he's never going to swim out as far as that. Again, it's very similar to the Wire story.
He even thinks that, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's unlikely that story's going to end well. But again, I've left it hanging a bit because it's about the process of that. Yeah, that complacency. I mean, with that story in particular, I was interested in tying in that idea of complacency with an idea of tourism and the kind of naivety of the tourist. And especially in this case, he's a tourist not in a war zone, but in a country that was recently experienced war. Just slightly glibly kind of thinking about what that experience means for the people there. Yeah, mixing in that idea of the complacency with the naivety of the tourist.
And if we can talk just for a second about how you crafted that story. The beginning is in a more omniscient voice, and then you move to the second person. Can you tell us about how you choose the closeness, the proximity of the voice?
I can try. Because I wrote the first version of that, 2004, 2005, something like that. But I think it always was second person. There's something about second person which can give you the immediacy of the first person voice and the kind of interiority of the first person voice, but at the same time, that kind of outside looking in perspective of the third person. So it kind of situates the reader not as the boy in the sea,
yes,
but kind of looking over the shoulder, but at the same time being forced to imagine themselves into that that situation.
Because the boy is being interpolated in you, but then if you're in the consciousness of somebody who's in the sea, unless you're writing a ghost story, you know that they probably will survive. Whereas when you're using the second person, they might not.
Yes. I think I'm using the second person. It has the same tone as some of those kind of choose-your-own-adventure type texts. It's like the games master kind of telling you to imagine yourself into a particular situation. Come with me, dear reader. You are in the sea. You are swimming. You have swum too far out. Quite didactically kind of forcing the reader into the water.
Yes, it's quite chilling, even though it's warm. Because we're aware of the danger and we're aware of that looming disaster. Much more so, probably, than in Wires. And water is recurrent, because all these stories, even the story of somebody in a Eastern European country swimming in the sea, are linked in some way to the Fenlands. Each story has a subtitle of a place. I think this really comes out very strongly, the sense of flood, the sense of water as a force, It operates as an image, as a metaphor, but it also operates as a force. It comes through very strongly in the story, If It Keeps Raining, and I was wondering if you would mind reading us the start of that one.
This is how his days begin, if you really want to know. Standing in his doorway in the cold, wet morning light and pissing on the stony ground. Waking up and getting out of bed and walking across the rough wooden floor. Opening the door and pulling down the front of his pyjamas and the weight of a whole night's piss pouring out onto the stony ground and winding down to the river which flows out to the sea. The relief of it. The long, sighing relief of it. He has to hold on to the doorframe to keep his balance. He looks at the swirl and churn of the river. Boats passing, driftwood and debris. A drowned animal turning slowly in the current. Sometimes the people in the boats wave, but he doesn't wave back. He didn't ask them to come sweeping past like that while he's having his morning piss. In their shining white boats with the chrome guardrails and the tinted windows and the little swim decks on the stern. As if they'd ever swim in this river. They can come past if they like, but they shouldn't expect him to wave. Not when his hands are full. Sometimes there's a man fishing on the other side of the river. It's too far to see his face, so it's hard to tell whether the man can see what he's doing. But if he could, he wouldn't be embarrassed. This is his house now, and there's nothing to stop him pissing on his own ground when he wakes up each day.
Thank you. You tell us about this story.
Yeah, it's probably the oldest story in the collection. And it's a story I remember starting work on while I was waiting for my first novel to be published in 2002. And I was actually living on a boat at the time and doing a fair bit of travelling on the boat. Along stretches of the River Trent, in particular, and the River Ouse in Yorkshire, I remember seeing quite a lot of kind of shacks and cabins and caravans by the side of the river, kind of set back on high ground. Mm-hmm. You know, very kind of temporary-looking houses. I don't know what the word would be, maybe informal housing. You can imagine people have not really got proper kind of planning permission to live there. They're supposed to be holiday homes, but some of them looked occupied fairly much year-round and occupied by men on their own, almost exclusively, as were lots of the boats, actually. Most of the people I met who lived on boats tended to be men in their 40s and 50s who'd come out the other side of a relationship or a job or some kind of life crisis and were living on their own and were fairly kind of insular and bitter. And I was really struck by these men and what they were doing and how they were living and how they saw the world. That was something I was trying to capture in this story. So I guess that was the starting point. A man in a shack by a river with various things that he's bitter about in his life. And then the rain comes, and the rain keeps coming. He starts picturing ways he can save his loved ones or the people around him or the world. Yeah, I guess it became a story about bitter, lonely men and their rescue fantasies.
He seems like a prophet. He's building a Noah's Ark, which is a treehouse, and he seems to have a quite apocalyptic vision of the world that in one reality exists.
Yeah, and I think in some ways that story, it kind of stands for something of the logic of the collection as a whole, in that there's a kind of apocalyptic vision underlying the whole collection. And it's to do with the threat of climate change and the threat of flooding. And Lincolnshire in particular, the Fenlands, are incredibly vulnerable to sea level change. And, you know, you always have the sense in Lincolnshire, well, it is an artificial landscape, and it's a landscape that's been kind of drained, clawed back from nature as it is. And you always have this sense of the sea kind of lurking behind the horizon, ready to come flooding in. And I'm quite interested in people. I mean, there's another story with a kind of environmentalist activist group who are very kind of apocalypse-minded. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in the extent to which those people are not wrong. These threats are perfectly feasible and perfectly logical. And maybe it's the rest of us who are crazy and kind of pushing
complacent.
It to the back of our minds, and exactly, and being complacent. But in this story, for this man in particular, his rescue fantasy involves rescuing his children from whom he's estranged, and there's something kind of a bit desperate and a bit kind of lost about this idea that he's building this treehouse and suddenly he'll pluck his children to safety.
He's suffering from some kind of post-traumatic stress?
Yeah. Yeah, he is. I'd almost forgotten about that element. Yes, yeah, he was a police officer in Hillsborough. Although Hillsborough's never mentioned.
Yes. But he has clear images of things that push, the pushing, the kind of unstoppable flood of people.
Yeah, the unstoppable force of the crowd and the flood of people and the flood of the water. Yeah, he's a troubled soul. Mm.
It's a very affecting story, I think, for those reasons, that you are taken into that third-person limited consciousness and you're really shown a vision of the world. And I was struck, obviously, a lot of thought has gone in into the ordering of these stories, but I was struck that the following story was about a different element altogether. And I was wondering if you would mind reading us Fleeing Complexity.
Mm-hmm. Fleeing Complexity. The fire spread quicker than the little bastard was expecting.
Thank you. And Fleeing Complexity is the title of a competition you judged for Granta, I believe.
Yes.
For one sentence
That's
stories.
Right. Yep. That must have been around the time the book came out. Yeah, I think they were one sentence stories that people had to submit via Twitter. Yeah, but I mean, again, that's an extreme example. But that, again, that's an example of a story where I had much bigger plans. They had a whole backstory worked out. I had the whole kind of relationship between a farmer and this young kind of teenager tearaway. And every time I wrote more of the story, it felt redundant. And I just kept going back to that opening line. And in the end, I thought, well, the reader can work out what they want with the rest of it. I
mean, it points to a larger story.
You can always do that. You can always cut back a story and cut back and cut back and cut back until there's nothing left. And, you know, one of the pleasures of writing a story is in the elaboration and is in kind of closing down the other possibilities and giving the reader a bit more. But it was fun to leave that story as it stands and leave it like that and almost kind of make the point that this can still be a story as well. Mm-hmm.
So I suppose the question is, what is a story? Why does that become a story?
Yeah, it's a good question. Every time you try and define a story, somebody pops up with a kind of counterexample. But the best definition I have come across is that a story is anything that involves a process of change. And as soon as you have some element of change, then you've got a story on your hand. If you were just to kind of write the kind of literary equivalent of a still life, just describe a bowl of fruit, then you wouldn't really be telling a story. You would just be describing a bowl of fruit. But if you described the bowl of fruit over the course of a week, as that fruit was decaying, or not even decaying, but just gradually ripening and rotting or whatever, then maybe that has become a story because change has occurred. Wouldn't necessarily be a very interesting story, but it would be a story, I think. Yeah. Change.
I would agree. I think it's a really excellent definition of what a story is. And that one line made me think of the way stories are kind of suggested by lyrics. And I know you've said that you've been influenced by song lyrics, by Pulp in particular. And I was wondering, is there a relationship between the song lyric and your stories?
That's a good question. I particularly enjoy songs which tell stories. Bands that I've most responded to have been bands like Pulp, which have a very kind of storytelling element to them. But at the same time, you know, a song is doing something very different. A song has a different toolkit to work with. I have become increasingly resistant to writing which aspires to be song-like or musical. I mean, you know, writing is doing something different. I'm always quite wary of art forms which are trying to trespass on other territories.
But you do use some kind of intertextuality in some of these stories, don't you? In Winter the Sky, you have a poem running alongside the story.
Yeah.
Which, okay, poetry and prose are less different than lyrics and prose. In Last Ditch, it's a report, isn't it? And there's also the supplementary notes to the testimony of B&E, which is, again, taking the form of commentary on events.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun in this collection exploring different ways of presenting a story to the reader, different ways of using text. But I think I was keen to keep myself to written text. I mean, the parallel text in Winter the Sky is essentially my own commentary on my own rewrite of an older version of the same story, potentially a bit self-indulgent. I mean, I think the thing I realised once I was kind of deep into putting this collection together was it's a relatively rare opportunity to publish a collection of stories. And whereas when you publish single stories, you often are restricted in terms of form and length.
Yes.
In a collection, you really can do what you want. I suddenly realised this was my one opportunity to really kind of play with form and the footnotes, the supplementary notes story. Yeah, Last Ditch was a kind of report to the superior. It was fun. I mean, I like presenting the reader with a text where essentially none of the story is on the surface. It's all underneath yes. the surface.
So again, the readers doing the work, yeah. which I think readers really enjoy. They really like to feel that they've cracked it. It's mm-hmm. almost as if you're leaving them a trail of clues and mm-hmm. they're making sense of it, and so it helps them to feel that they're participating.
Yeah.
And of course, the final piece in the book, which is just a list of place names.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Okay, so it's literally just a list of place names, and it's doing a few different jobs. It's called Memorial Stone, and the idea is if you follow the whole direction of travel of the stories in the collection is towards a kind of apocalyptic vision.
Because it's a memorial.
The end of Lincolnshire, yes. essentially, you know, when the sea comes over the flood wall and everything is obliterated. It's a kind of dark vision. So the idea is that this would literally be a memorial stone of all the villages mm-hmm. that are drowned. But it's also, I'm really interested in place names as a kind of narrative history of mm-hmm. the place and the meanings of names. Each group of names tells a historical narrative of the area. So the first set is place names that ending in well, which is would have been the earliest settlements because it's where the mm-hmm. springs were. And then all the places that end in ham were, I think, Viking settlements. The kind of meanings of the place names move on through mm-hmm. Saxons and Normans and the more contemporary ones. And then you get to the ones to do with floods. There's dikes, the defences, the gates, the floodgates. And then you get on to the bridges and the floods. Then all the ones with saints. So it's almost like the villages kind of praying for salvation.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, all of the ends. And then the last paragraph is a list of place names which are elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So people have gone from, you know, there are places in Lincolnshire called London, Jerusalem, Gibraltar, Boston, and people have gone elsewhere and mm-hmm. kind of created new cities, and that's mm-hmm. a kind of vision of exile. So the whole thing on the surface looks like just an index of place names, but actually mm-hmm. there's quite a clear kind of narrative
line to going it.
On. But it's also part of this kind of project where I sat down and thought, right, anything can be a story. This mm-hmm. can be a story. But it's got that mm-hmm. process of change mm-hmm. that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm. My final question to you was going to be, can anything be a story?
Okay.
So that beautifully summed it up. But I wondered, have you been to all the places that have stories attached to them?
Probably not all of them. I mean, a lot, there's a mixture. So some of the stories are directly inspired by the places that are named.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the place names were later attached to a story I'd already written mm-hmm. because I'd seen that place and kind of decided mm-hmm. that was a good fit. And then some of the place names I looked up on Google Maps
mm-hmm.
because I wanted to continue that notion of giving each story a very fixed location.
Fixed place.
But I did, while I was working on this collection, I did quite a lot of exploring in mm-hmm. Lincolnshire, a lot of cycling around and taking on board the kind of weirdness of the whole area.
It's like a geographical element to it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, yeah, I just find the whole place really creepy. You know, there's like Kevin Barry talks a lot about he talks about it in quite a kind of genuinely supernatural way about how different places hold an eeriness or a sense of dread or a
yes.
sense of kind of something terrible having happened in that one spot of a field. You know, he has this idea that if something terrible happens in a place that mood will always kind of linger. And there were certain moments, you know, I'd be cycling through Lincolnshire and just kind of come around a corner and just have this horrible kind of feeling of dread, this kind of feeling trapped. It's a huge landscape and it's incredibly open. But because of all the ditches and the dikes and the way that the roads are laid out, you can be 100 yards away from a farmhouse, but it can be 5 miles mm-hmm. around to get there. And there's something incredibly kind of claustrophobic about that.
About the space and the sky.
Yeah, yeah. So I think this whole book was a kind of exorcism of the feeling of dread of being in Lincolnshire.
Mm-hmm. But there are moments of real light in them as well, would you say?
I mean, I hope so. Yeah, yeah. It was a book I think when you're working on a novel, you get very kind of tied up in the kind of singularity of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And you're making everything hold together and you've got a vision of where you're going, and the deeper you get into it, the more you're invested in making it work, and everything becomes very kind of fixed and channeled. And when I was putting this collection together, I just kind of got about halfway through it and realised I was having a lot of fun. It felt very playful.
Yes.
And although plenty of the stories are kind of quite dark in tone, I hope some of them are funny as well. And I mean Wires.
Yeah, there is a real humour.
Wires about the girl potentially getting herself, potentially ending up in a horrible situation. It's a really fun story to read to an audience because there's something kind of quite light and playful about the tone of it. And writing a lot of the stories in this book kind of reminded me to enjoy writing.
Yes.
And have fun writing and be playful with writing, which was a good lesson to learn.
Great. Thank you, John. Thank you very much for talking to us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for your generous insights, because I'm sure our listeners will enjoy listening to you.
I hope so.
Thank you.
Thank you.